It's the time of year for high-stakes testing in schools, but the pandemic has changed things this month. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, everything you need to know about the state relaxing rules around standardized testing in schools. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, leaders from the interfaith group ICARE call for changes to criminal justice here in the 904. We'll tell you about that. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The state says statewide cases ticked up by less yesterday, about 1,600 new cases of coronavirus. Hospitalizations went up by 82 people, and deaths rose again. The death toll in the state from the virus now stands at 34,056. Nearly 7.3 million Florida residents have also received at least one dose of a vaccine. Now, here's some more news. Speaking of vaccines, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration say today they are recommending what they call a pause in the use of the single-dose Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine out of an abundance of caution. This, while an investigation is conducted into reports of exceedingly rare but potentially dangerous blood clots that have affected only a handful of vaccine recipients. We will continue to follow this story today at WJCT News and discuss it on tomorrow's show, too. Well, in this pandemic, parents and teachers have been pressing the state to give students a break from standardized testing. And their pleas have basically been answered. The Florida Department of Education now says standardized tests will not be tied to student promotion and high school graduation this year. This is a move that educators and parents are praising. Andrew Spahr is president of the Florida Education Association, and he's on the line. Hi, Andrew. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
I'm good, and thanks for joining us. Give us a call as we talk about new rules for standardized tests in schools. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, let's begin by explaining what just happened, Andrew. The State Department of Education has put out a statement about this.
The Commissioner of Education put out an emergency order that essentially gives districts the ability to say we're not going to use test scores in a punitive way against our students. In Florida, students who do not pass the third grade state assessment, known as the Florida State Assessment, the FSA, if they do not pass it in third grade, they're not supposed to go on to fourth grade. And districts now have the flexibility to say we're not going to use that assessment for that determination, and students may be promoted to third grade. And the same is true for graduation, that students need to pass the 10th grade FSA in order to graduate. And of course, typically students who do not pass it in 10th grade have many opportunities to retake that exam. But because of COVID last year and this year, that really has put students at a disadvantage. And so the commissioner, again, is giving the districts the ability to not use those test scores for student graduation either. And then finally, the other big thing that this order does is that it says that schools will not be graded unless a district wants individual schools in their district to be graded, and they can make that determination once the test results are out. In other words, if they look at a school that maybe has been struggling and this year they actually are able to improve that grade, we don't think there's a lot of schools in that situation because of disruptions, they'll be able to say we want to count that grade, and then that school would get an improvement, but all other schools would not be negatively penalized by school grades this year because of a lack of students taking the tests, because so many students are still using live stream as an option, or because students just don't perform as well this year because of the disruptions in the learning process. The only thing we felt the order didn't do enough on was protecting teachers in this scenario. Teachers' evaluations are tied to student test scores.
Right.
And the commissioner did not say you don't have to tie student test scores to teacher evaluations this year. He said that districts would have flexibility in how they do that, but there's still a requirement that student test scores be used in teacher evaluation in this very not normal year. So we're now working with school districts. For example, in Jacksonville, I know Terry Brady, the president of the Duval Teachers United, is talking with the superintendent, Dr. Green, about making some adjustments to ensure that teachers aren't negatively penalized by the fact that this, in fact, is not a normal year.
Well, let me ask you as a follow-up, if the tests aren't really going to be used for anything, what's the point of taking the tests? Why are the kids still taking the tests?
You know, so here's the thing that, you know, you ask any teachers, and we always say this, teachers invented tests, right? You know, if you think about it, teachers were the first ones to invent tests, and it was a way for teachers to tell, are students making ground? Where are they? Where do we need to focus the instruction on, and what kind of help do we need to provide students, maybe some additional support? That's what testing was initially created for. What we've seen over the last couple of decades is this shift to use tests, quite honestly, in a lot of punitive ways, not just to gauge how students are doing, but to create consequences for students who don't perform well, to create consequences for the schools and for the teachers and staff in those schools. And that, as teachers have said for years, is not an appropriate use of tests. You know, when I think back to when I was in school, I remember state tests. We were usually told the day before, hey, we're going to do this important test tomorrow. Make sure you get a good night's sleep. We'll see you in the morning. It won't be a normal day. That's all we were told. You know, it wasn't, hey, let's start talking about it on day one of the school year. Let's put all this pressure on kids and on the system and on students, because there's going to be consequences with funding. There's going to be consequences with whether or not you get to another grade level.
And will all of this that's happening in the pandemic, will this give those that are opposed to high stakes testing momentum to continue their push to do away with these tests, or to at least take so much pressure off the test? A growing number of parents are opting their kids out of taking the test, even though they're not really allowed to do so.
Yeah, look, not everyone tests well, and that's what we lose in this. A test is just one way to assess student learning. A test should not be the end-all and be-all, especially a test given on one day of the year, you know, because there are so many kids. My daughter is a straight-A student, does really well, got into every college she's applied for this year. She's doing wonderful. She's not a great test taker. And it doesn't mean she doesn't have the intelligence and the smarts and the knowledge to be successful. It means she doesn't have a great set in terms of taking a test. And so tests very often, and we see this in test review and test preps, it's about understanding how to answer the questions on a test. It's not always about understanding the knowledge. You know, we've been pushing for this concept of project-based learning, because project-based learning allows you to through a project to develop and show, learn, to learn, but to also show what you've learned and your skill set through projects and things like that. I mean, when you go to work, no one says, here's your test, let's see if you're doing your work well. They look at how you're doing your work, which is usually producing a product of some kind, and saying, hey, as a matter of fact, you are doing really well at that. And for some reason, there's been this mindset over the last 20 years that tests should be the end all and be all.
It's 549-2937 as we speak with Andrew Spahr, president of the FEA. 549-2937. New rules this spring for standardized tests for school children. Here is a comment on Facebook from Mel. They say, are the rules going to be relaxed for those in grades 4 through 10, as well as kids in 3rd and 12th grades?
And yes, the answer is yes. This is applying to all kids in our schools where these tests will not be used in any kind of punitive way. It's still going to give us information. We're still going to be able to determine what we need to do to continue the learning process, to see, you know, how much of an impact there's been from the disruptions this year. You know, let's not forget, there's been a lot of quarantining. There's been a lot of COVID cases in our schools. That's created the disruption in the learning process. And so we certainly want to make sure that we are using the test data to help us guide the learning. but is not going to be used in a punitive way on any kids in our schools.
Here's an email. Why did the state wait until districts had already started testing to announce this? Both my kids are still required to take the test, she says.
Yeah, that's a great question. We were pushing, as some lawmakers were as well, because there were bills in the legislature. There was a big push to get these decisions made sooner rather than later. But clearly the Department of Education waited until the writing portion of the test was completed, which was done last week in most districts. And so it seems that, you know, they wanted to get the testing started before ultimately deciding. I think some of it's politics. I think because the legislature was moving some bills and the Department of Education wanted to be the ones to come out with this policy, they got ahead of it before the legislature passed the legislation.
Here's another email from Joe. I'm a retired teacher and feel the disregard for passing a test for graduation waters down an already slipping educational system, he says. It's 549-2937. Let us know what you think about this. Amelia is in Springfield. Hi, Amelia. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, Melissa. I just have a quick point. When DeSantis became governor, he was very quick to, go to a new standard system, the best standards, which is set to roll out next year. Was wondering if anyone else had the opinion that maybe we should put the pause button on that as well, considering that there's going to be a pretty big learning curve for all of our teachers to have to adjust to that as well. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for that. And Andrew Spahr, building on her question, could the pandemic bring other changes that we might not even have contemplated yet when it comes to schools and classes?
Yeah, so first on the best standards, which are the new standards coming into play, they're not a huge shift, and it's a lot of things that many of the teachers were looking for, tweaks to the standards, if you will, that we had. But it is a different set of standards, and hence we've been asking as well for the opportunity again to delay the requirement or how we utilize these assessments until these new standards are in place. Whenever you put new standards in place, which again, these are going to start next school year, you often see a dip in student performance as we adjust to the standards and the assessment isn't aligned with those standards. So clearly, I think it's Amelia's right. We should really be looking at that. And I don't know that it necessarily requires us to delay the standards, but there should be, again, an acknowledgement that next year as we implement new standards, it's going to mean something different as it relates to these state assessments. In terms of, Melissa, in terms of what we've learned during this pandemic, we've learned that virtual learning is not the end-all and be-all.
Really? You don't say.
And there were a lot of people pushing that idea.
I could talk about that
pandemic
for a long time based on my own experience at home. Go ahead with your thoughts about that.
Yeah, but there was a big push before the pandemic to get a lot more virtual in, and now we're seeing that everyone has realized in-person learning does matter, and it does that interaction between students and between students and the teacher is vitally important to occur in person, and that while there is a value and a place for virtual learning, it shouldn't be the only thing we're doing. We've also learned that our public schools are essential to student learning. They're the best place for student learning. And you know what else? It's the place where we bring families together. You know, I think that often gets lost, I have two daughters in the school system in Volusia County. And when they have programs, I go to the school. I see some of my neighbors who I don't always see in the neighborhood, but I see them at school because it is a place where we come together these days as families. And that's been vitally missed during this pandemic. And then, of course, for the economic well-being, we know our public schools are essential for that economic well-being of every individual in our community. And so, clearly we should be talking about how are we supporting our public schools, how are we investing in our public schools, and how are we making sure we address the learning challenges that our students face this year in all of these disruptions so that they are given the education they deserve.
Susan in Mandarin. Hello, Susan. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask a general question about how we compare schools of choice. So testing, I understand, is one of the ways, and that's how each school gets a grade. So I don't think, and I hope, hopefully you'll clarify this for me, do the private schools that are getting our voucher money have to be tested and compared to the charter schools that are getting money and then our district-run schools? There was an op-ed in the Times Union that said that only 50% of school-age K-12 students go to the neighborhood school, which what your guest just said is my memory, too. The neighborhood school should be a big part of our community, and I wish our state legislature would invest more money in the community school concept, which I think Duval County calls the full-service concept. So I just, overall, how do we compare these schools of choice? And does he support SB 48, which expands money going to private schools? And Mr. Charchan wrote a Times Union editorial that he supports HB 1061, which would make it easier for charter schools to open up in Florida. And if I read the bill correctly, it would also cause our sales surtax money to be spent on charter schools in other parts of the state. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, a lot there from you. Thank you, Susan.
Yeah, so let me start with, in Florida, the schools that we call voucher schools, because most of schools, private schools that take vouchers, exclusively take vouchers, and were created for the purpose of taking vouchers and have zero accountability. So they are not required to take any form of state assessment. And so, you know, they always say all the parents will know if the school is a good school, but they don't report any information out. And then, of course, with our public schools, there's a ton of information reported out, some of which we argue with. In terms of Senate Bill 84, which is a massive expansion of the voucher program, no, I don't think that's a good bill because, again, we've learned during this pandemic that our public schools, it's actually where 90% students in Florida attend our public schools. We should be supporting our public schools. It is, in fact, the best place to learn. And we saw how vital our public schools were during this pandemic when the governor came out and said, open them and open them now, regardless of the safety measures that are being put in place. So clearly, and I should say, our teachers and staff and administrators in our schools did just that. They did everything to protect the kids, keep the kids learning, and make sure that our schools were open and that the community was operating. Without our public school teachers and the staff and the administrators, our communities would not be up and running the way they are now, nor would the state of Florida.
And of course, you're right, the majority of kids do attend public schools. But just to be fair, kids at other kinds of schools, those teachers did their best to keep the kids safe, too, and educate the kids in challenging circumstances, too. Just wanted to say that.
Yeah. There's no doubt that, you know, people who work with kids care about kids, right? But the question, I think, is what kind of accountabilities are put in place, and what is the fair comparison? I always find it interesting that there's this mindset, and I think this is where Senate Bill 84 goes to continue to increase the hoops that our public schools have to jump through. But what Senate Bill 84 does is actually decrease even more, which is already almost zero, any kind of accountability on private school voucher programs. One of the things Senate Bill 84 would do is right now it requires an annual audit for the organization who runs these private school vouchers. It would go to every 3 years for an audit requirement. Again, that limits the oversight. Meanwhile, our public schools have to report out and audit every year, of course, and we should expect that. It's taxpayer money, and so are these voucher programs. They're taxpayer money, but they're unaccountable. And the same thing with the voucher program, 1061, what it's going to do is it's basically going, or 1060, if it was, I'm sorry, but what that bill is going to do essentially is it's going to create a board and take the oversight of charter schools out of local school boards and out of the local community. And again, this comes back to local control, knowing what's going on in a community, and being able to be transparent in the work that's happening. And again, it's creating unequal playing fields, if you will, as it relates to the education of our children.
And Andrew, getting back to standardized tests, do you advise parents to just contact their schools? Because districts are handling this in different ways. Parents should contact the school to get the full rundown on what their child will be dealing with. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It is best to talk to your school's principal, and find out what they're going to be doing again. And listen, even if as a parent you have a concern, like you may think my kid has missed too much this year. You may feel that maybe they did the distance learning for a longer period of time, and you feel that they aren't where they need to be. You know, you can have that and should have that conversation with your child's teacher, with your child's principal, to determine what is the best course of action. Is there programs during the summer that's going to occur? Is there going to be extra support next year? Do I consider retaining my child? Those conversations should be conversations that the parent has with the teacher and with the principal at the school.
Thanks so much. He's Andrew Sparr. He's president of the Florida Education Association. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
And much more still ahead later. How you can be part of the world's biggest art caper. Not the real one, but something happening on the downtown streets of Jacksonville this week. We'll tell you all about it. But up next.
We're concerned about the fact that there are a large number of arrests in our community.
Faith leaders press police and prosecutors on crime rates in Duval as we speak with iCare in a moment. That's after this. Well, there are a citywide coalition of dozens of local churches and faith groups. iCare, or the Interfaith Coalition for Action, Reconciliation, and Empowerment, works as a group using the strength of their numbers to press our local elected officials on countywide solutions to the problems that plague this community. Crime tops the list. Now, iCare's upcoming Nehemiah Assembly is coming up next Monday. I got a preview with three of their local leaders, the Reverend Tan Moss of Greater Grant Memorial AME Church, the Reverend Bill Hoff of Riverside Presbyterian, and Ken Christensen, PhD, with iCare's Group Violence Intervention Committee. Gentlemen, it's great to have all three of you on the show. Thanks for being with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
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 Well, let's begin with you, Reverend Moss. As you look forward to this Nehemiah Action Assembly on the 19th, you will have the presence of the school superintendent, the sheriff, and the state attorney. Let's begin with the topic of arrests and civil citations and your concern about how that's playing out across the region. What's going to be discussed?
Well, we're concerned about the fact that there are a large number of arrests in our community. In 2019, there were more than 32,000 adults that were arrested, and nearly a third of these arrests were for minor offenses, things like driving on a suspended license. And we're going to be asking our sheriff to use an effective and a meaningful diversion program called civil citations to curb and reduce these unnecessary adult arrests. We've seen tremendous success with civil citation with our young people and reducing the number of young people who were arrested and being given civil citations and going through a diversion program. And we believe that something like this is very possible for adults mm-hmm. who have committed minor offenses for driver's license or not paying fees and fines and things of that nature.
Right. With juveniles, there was a big push on iCare's part to have civil citations used more for juveniles. How challenging, though, do you think it will be to convince law enforcement to move this practice into the adult world?
Well, we've done the research, and we know that it is possible. It is the same principle. These are minor offenses. People have fees and fines assessed against them, and for whatever reason, generally because they're unable to pay them, they don't pay the fines and fees, and they are sometimes their licenses are suspended and having to go to work. They may be stopped, and once they find determine that their license have been suspended, they may be arrested. And we just believe that there's a better way, because what happens is you basically are criminalizing poverty, people who are unable to pay fines, lose their driver's license, unable to work, and many times go to jail, have their family lives interrupted, and it's not making our community any safer. And so the same principles that apply with the young people apply with these adults. And we believe that that there can be a program developed that provides diversion for these minor offenses instead of arrest.
Now let's bring in another important element to this discussion, how mental health issues interact with policing. Bill Hoff, you know, calls to defund the police have been quite controversial in America. But what police reform advocates have been saying is that they would like to see resources reallocated to better address the mental health crisis we have in this country, because often the only mental health treatment people get is at the local jail. And we certainly see that in Duval County. So how will this be viewed, and what are you asking law enforcement and the other players that will be taking part in this to consider when it comes to mental health?
Thank you for that, Melissa. We know that mental illness is a widespread problem, and our Sheriff's Department does conduct entry-level training with new recruits when people join the force. But we have studied this problem and believe that we can do better. We think that the police department needs more specialized training, and we have found models that work in other cities. In Miami-Dade, specifically, we've talked with folks down there extensively about how they've had success with a program called Crisis Intervention Training. And it's training for officers who have been in the field for a little bit of time, who volunteer for this specialized training, and who have dedicated supervision and other resources available to them so that they can respond in a way. They'll have more tools, more training to respond to mentally ill citizens in Jacksonville so that fewer of them are hurt, fewer officers are hurt, and fewer people are put in jail, and more are going to receive the treatment they need.
This is such a timely topic, given that even as we record this, you know, there are protests taking place in Minnesota where there was another deadly altercation between a police officer and a driver who was stopped by the authorities. So often these incidents escalate because perhaps the person being detained might have a mental health problem, and because police aren't always properly trained for these kinds of situations. So are you saying that police should be better trained, or are you also saying that police shouldn't shoulder such a large burden of dealing with those with mental health problems? Should other resources be brought to bear that are outside of law enforcement in a way that we're not doing now?
Melissa, clearly, the mental health crisis in our country will require many reforms and more resources on a lot of levels. Here in Jacksonville, we know, and in Florida, that we do not fund mental health services very well, and that our capacity isn't what it needs to be. There's a waiting list for most kinds of treatment. However, our officers are often the first line, the first responders.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are on the street, and so they don't have a choice. In many cases, they have to respond immediately. They're called into situations. Sometimes they don't know if it will be a mental illness related call or not until they get there. And so that's why we need our officers not to have just basic training, but to have at least a percentage of our officers that have specialized training. And we know that this has proven to reduce jail time and arrests in other cities. It has proven to save money. And so we think that the sheriff's office we understand it's a tough job they have. It's not easy what they're being asked to do, but we think that we can offer better training and demand better training as citizens.
So amidst all of these discussions, Ken Christensen, you're with ICARE's Group Violence Intervention Committee. You're also going to be bringing up the ongoing issue of violent crime in this community and a high homicide rate. Unfortunately, that's just a steady drumbeat of life in this city. Now, the city has started a program called Cure Violence, where they're attempting to address this. You have another program that you plan to talk about at the Nehemiah Assembly. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, the city actually has also cooperated with this program. In 2016 till early 2019, they brought in a team from Group Violence Intervention from the National Network of Safe Communities, and it was started in the city. In most cities where it happens, there is a very dramatic reduction in incidents of killings and shootings with injury. That is the focus of this group. And in most cities, you can really tell the program's there. In Jacksonville, it's been much harder to tell. And so what we're asking now is that the sheriff's office bring in the National Network of Safe Communities to do a project evaluation, a significant evaluation of all factors. All this has to be done, of course, with a great deal of confidentiality, which the National Network for Safe Communities can do, but we hope their report will be, at least in many ways, public. To figure out why it's not working here. There are a lot of factors that go into group violence intervention to make it work. And I can talk about that if you wish.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. First three elements, really big elements are necessary, are focus on the relatively small areas where most of the violence is taking place, balance between really strong enforcement, but also support for people who want to get out of that lifestyle, support for people who are interested in making a change in their communities. And if this is done right, there will be a sense of fairness and the community will see this program as legitimate. An extremely tiny portion in most cities of a given area is generally responsible for the majority of the gun violence. Based on the experience of many cities, violence-prone groups typically constitute less than 5%, or 0.5% of a city's population, but are consistently linked to 60 to 70% of the shootings and homicides. Where both police and community resources are often limited, a program like group violence intervention works by directing available resources to the root of the violence problem. You might wonder, how does it work? Well, first of all, it has to be supported by local leaders and needs a full-time project director. Beyond that, a working group needs to be gathered, comprised of local community representatives, law enforcement, social service providers, and ideally, an outside research group such as a college or university. A key tool is the call-in. This is when the community representatives, law enforcement, and social service providers meet directly and personally with members of those groups who are most prone to violence. It's a big job for everyone, most central to the sheriff's office and the project director, to get these people together in a meeting. Community representatives who come often include parents of victims and or formerly incarcerated individuals who walked away from a life of violence. These people can help set the tone of the meeting. This process is what the community wants. They communicate and is not being driven by law enforcement. Rather, law enforcement is acting at the behest of the community. This helps to increase the legitimacy of enforcement actions. Am I going too fast?
No.
I
hate to cut you off, but this gives everyone just a taste of the robust discussion you're going to have next Monday night, April 19th, at the ICARE Nehemiah Action Assembly. As I mentioned, School Superintendent Diana Green, Sheriff Mike Williams, and State Attorney Melissa Nelson will all be attending, as ICARE, as it's known to do, will hold a community-wide discussion about this vital issue of public safety in Jacksonville. This is kicking off Monday, April 19th at 6:45 p.m. They will have limited in-person attendance and virtual attendance. Go to iCareJax.org for more. And I want to thank all three of you, the Reverend Tan Moss, co-president of iCare with the Greater Grant Memorial AME Church, the Reverend Bill Hoff, Riverside Presbyterian Church, and Ken Christensen, PhD, with iCare's Group Violence Intervention Committee. Again, iCareJax.org. Gentlemen, thank you so much, and I'm sure it will be a great discussion.
Thank you.
Well, the pandemic has got millions of Americans reading more than ever before. We have an idea for you now for a new book to pick up. If you're familiar with Frank McCourt, who wrote the wonderful Angela's Ashes, or another Irish author, Colm McCann, then The Country Girls by Edna O'Brien might pique your interest. This month, our book club is reading O'Brien's The Country Girls Trilogy. Why did we choose this book for April? Well, our book club leader, Stacey Goldring, is on the line to explain. Hey, Stacey, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Melissa?
I'm good, and it's good to hear your voice. So this month, our book club is reading The Country Girls, the trilogy by Edna O'Brien. What prompted this selection?
Well, you know, always on the hunt for that, finding those wonderful gems that don't get, all the headlines. And I stumbled across Edna O'Brien when I was researching some information about Anita Bruckner, who I've brought to your listeners months ago with Hotel du Lac, and also with Philip Roth, An American Pastoral. And I thought, I need to know more about this author. And my God, Melissa, I could not believe that I had not read her. And so I thought it was so important to bring her writing to our group. So yes, we are going to be discussing the Country Girls Trilogy. And I'm looking at the book right now on my kitchen counter, and I'm telling you, it is over 600 pages. But do not be alarmed, because it's three stories, and I'm only asking people to read the first, called The Country Girls, of the three. But Melissa, she is such a fabulous writer that the pages just turn. So it's super conversational. It's not dense. And, we start off in Ireland with two best friends, two young girls, Kate and her best friend, Baba. And they go off to a convent to go to school. And it's just this odyssey. The first story of two girls who are scrappy and they come from nothing. And it just has that beautiful Irish, I was thinking last night, how am I going to describe this writing to Melissa? And it's almost like it comes so raw from the heart. And I say it's dramatic how Edna writes, but it's also so human and real. And so, it hit the readers like a slap in the face when it was published in 1960 in Ireland. Mm. It was burned. It was censored. So already I'm there, sign me up, right? because it broke every boundary of how, women were expected to behave, how women writers were expected to write. And, if you think about maybe spending the night at your girlfriend's house when you were little and you have those really intense talks and you just, you uncover all the problems of the world. That's happening on every page between the dialogue of these two friends as they end up working in Dublin together. And it's the 1960s, so you get that whole vibe of that particular culture and what people were wearing. So there's like polyester involved and blue eyeshadow. And it's also about women's rights and where do young women who are evolving at this time fit in the world with their relationships with men, with education, with poverty. I know I'm rambling, but
no, that's
I'm
all right.
Just,
and
it's a winner.
You wanted to point out too that for those who've been watching PBS's series on Ernest Hemingway, they might recognize the name Edna O'Brien from that television program because she's featured there as well.
Exactly. I'd like to say that we planned this, right? But it just so happens that, you know, our PBS right now is streaming this fabulous doc about Hemingway. And I've been getting calls and emails and texts from people saying, my gosh, they're interviewing Edna O'Brien. And I said, look.
About Hemingway, all, yeah.
And I haven't seen it yet because I'm very goal-oriented. So until the book groups are over, I'm not going to watch anything on PBS about Edna because I want it. You know, that's just how I do my research. But it just goes to show you that the more you read, the more it's almost like you're all showing up at the same cocktail party and you're running into these familiar friends, like I've ever gone to a cocktail party. But anyway, so you're running into these like familiar faces. Well, no, I always picture like the Dick Van Dyke Show and like, you know, they're hosting. I want to go to their cocktail party. Anyway, you just meet these people who you've been reading about and you run into and you know what? It's almost like they have their own little fraternity or, you know, sorority of just people trying to express themselves through the written word, and they support one another, you know, like friends, like you and me, like everyone, you know, we support one another. And that network happens with writers too. You know, Gertrude Stein pops up, I understand, in the Hemingway doc, and we just read her recently. So, it pays to read, because even if it's not, even if it's fiction, it affects the nonfiction in your world.
That's right.
That makes sense.
Now, you join us every month to talk books. That's one part of the show's book club. But you also conduct actual book club groups all over town, and you're going to be conducting two next week as you talk about Edna O'Brien's The Country Girl. These will be online, correct?
Yes, right now we're still online, but we're very eager to get back face-to-face. But right now we're still online. We're next Tuesday at 11 a.m., or you can join us Thursday evening at 7 p.m. for our discussion of the first book of the trilogy called The Country Girls by Edna O'Brien. Just go to Chapter and Notes and sign up for the discussion, or reach out to us right here at the station. And that email, I believe, is bookclub@wjct.org.
That's right. Email Stacy at bookclub@wjct.org and join her virtual discussion next week. Whatever you're reading in this pandemic, I hope you're enjoying it. I've got a lot of books piled up on my bed table that I need to get to, too. So always good to hear your voice, Stacy Goldring, and her website again, chapterandnotes.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, a quick break. And when we come back, it was called The World's Biggest Art Caper. You can re-experience that with some live theater happening on the streets of downtown Jacksonville beginning tonight. Yes. We'll tell you about Art Heist, a true crime walking show in the urban core. You won't want to miss this. We'll be right back.
The Jacksonville Business Journal produces special events to recognize industry leaders and facilitate professional networking. Event listings and registration info at bizjournals.com/Jacksonville.
Lee & Kate's Glass, family owned and operated for 95 years. Lee & Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com.
Concerns in France about the AstraZeneca vaccine have led to unused doses piling up. Some people there are getting picky about which of the other vaccines they might take, Moderna or Pfizer.
Some people who get Moderna, they feel like they have an handicap because they didn't get Pfizer.
A handicap because they didn't get Pfizer? Vaccine Shopping in France. It's on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. A new memoir has a message for liberal white parents looking to adopt black children. Author Rebecca Carroll says her well-meaning adoptive white parents told her they didn't see her color.
The message therein is, the only way I will love you is if I strip you of something that is so integral to your identity.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
President Biden has promised to build back better. But early pushback to his multi-trillion dollar infrastructure bill is coming from those who want to define what infrastructure means. The White House says that's absurd.
To me, it makes no sense to say, I would have been for broadband, but I'm against it because it's not a bridge.
Imagining America Reengineered. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, put your CSI and Law and Order skills to use tonight and walk off those quarantine pounds to solve a real-life master robbery of 13 works of art valued at $500 million. Based on a true story of the world's biggest art caper, Art Heist is a true crime walking show, an actual live show, where socially distanced groups of 30 to 35 people will move around the perimeter of the downtown Times Union Center to gather clues into the caper. And you can take part in all of this fun starting tonight. It's live theater for a socially distanced era. Art Heist writer and director TJ Daw is on the line to tell us all about it. Hey, TJ.
Hello, Jacksonville.
It's so good to talk to you. This sounds like so much fun. So this is an
great fun.
It sounds like, so it's interactive on the streets of Jacksonville and based on a real art heist?
Yes, true story. A crazy story. $500 million worth of art still unsolved. Not one arrest made, not one piece of art recovered. So, and there's a $10 million reward to this day from the museum it was stolen from. So if you see the show, which has, the story itself has actual Florida connections. I don't want to spoil those for anyone. I want them just to come up during the show, but suffice to say, Floridians are at a slight advantage over everybody else in terms of possibly finding the art. And if you do, you got $10 million coming to you.
Wow. Okay. So this is based on a heist that took place in 1990 from a museum in Boston when the thieves stole a bunch of art dressed as police officers. And so,
that's right, yeah.
Okay. So when people come down tonight to Art Heist, what will they experience? How does this whole live theater on the streets work?
They're going to be met by a guide. So there's always somebody there to tell you what's going to come up next, because we don't presume the audience knows this story. So there's different actors embodying different experts. One is the current security director of the Gardner Museum in Boston. Another one's a retired FBI agent, that kind of thing. And they'll gather the audience members and they give them a role. They say, welcome to the FBI. You are our newest batch of recruits in the FBI's brand new art recovery division. And we're going to get you looking at our coldest, hardest case, the Gardner robbery. And then they tell them all the details they need to know. This is what happened. This is when it happened. This is what we know. And here are the four suspects you are going to meet next. And they bring them to meet four different actors. They're very obvious about the fact that they're actors and not the real suspects. But they say, mm-hmm. We want you to interrogate these people. So the audience is fed information. This is why we think this next person is suspicious. You might want to ask him about this thing. Here are some things that don't really seem to add up. And then the audience as a group has 10 minutes to interrogate each suspect. You can ask them anything you want. You can ask them questions based on the evidence we've given the audience. You can ask them, what's the worst haircut they've ever had? You can ask them anything of any kind, and their job is to answer in character. And at the end, you take a vote. Of the suspects you met, which one do you think is the most likely to be involved?
And each show is different because there's a lot of improvisation that goes on as well, correct?
Yes. Each show is completely different. And that's one of the joys of the show for the actors as well as for the audience, is every interaction that the audience has with a suspect, which is the bulk of the show, is a unique moment. And you might be asking that actor a question they've received before, but their answer is going to be specific to the way you asked it, the energy of the group, how they're feeling in that moment. And if you're so inclined, you might ask an actor a question nobody has asked them before. And the answer to that is going to be unique. It's going to be as unique as the question. Yeah. So there's a lot of real exchange happening between the audience and the actors, which is something that all of us have been deprived of for the last year because we've been subsisting on Netflix or we've been reading books or we've been watching TV, all of which is wonderful. I do all those things too. I love those things too. But they're the same every time. This is different every time.
This is brand new and different and COVID safe. Is that how you came up with the idea since it's outside?
Absolutely. I wish I could take credit for that, but I can't. It's our producer, Justin Suds, who discovered the loophole that if you do live theater outside and if you keep the audience 6 feet from each other and 10 feet from the performers, then nobody's at risk of contracting COVID. So we can have live theater outdoors that is fully safe, that follows all COVID safety protocols.
So Art Heist kicks off tonight, runs 3 different weeks through April at the Times Union Center. How can people be part of all the fun starting tonight?
Look up artheistexperience.com.
Artheistexperience.com. Do people need to buy tickets, TJ?
Yes.
They buy tickets there?
Yes, you can get tickets there or at the venue itself. You can just show up and get tickets at the door. But I would recommend getting tickets in advance. There's a new audience group leaving every 30 minutes between certain hours. And audiences cap out at, I believe, 35 people. So it's always an intimate group, but it's also big enough to bring your family or bring the people you've been in lockdown with. Audience tickets are sold in pods.
Check it out. It's the Art Heist tonight in downtown Jacksonville. Tickets at artheistexperience.com. Writer and director TJ Daw, congrats on such an innovative idea, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great fun to be a part of the show. I hope a lot of people see it.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Keep those emails coming. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also catch our podcast up later today wherever you like to listen. You can download our app, too, our WJCT app, and listen there. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.